Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's begin with reading the weather forecast for today, this coming from KCRG-TV. The headline is Grayer Skies and More Rainfall on the Way. Our active weather pattern is still underway, with our best chance for rain and storms yet to come. Light showers or drizzle are likely through the morning hours, as an area of rain generally stays to our southeast. Low clouds will be present as well, with some light fog possible. A few breaks in the clouds may develop later today, but expect much grayer conditions today than the last few days. One nice change, the wind will be much less intense, likely staying to a 5 to 15 mile per hour range from the southwest. With clouds and lighter winds, temperatures only make it to the upper 60s and low 70s, a paltry 10 to 15 degrees above normal. Areas of showers and storms move back into the area this evening and especially tonight into Thursday. This time period represents the best and most widespread rainfall out of this entire active weather pattern, with the highest rainfall totals of the several-day event likely during this time. Many areas will see rainfall of at least half an inch, with some spots receiving higher totals. The most likely area to see these highest amounts will be in our northern zones, closer to a frontal boundary that may serve as the focus for rain. A bit of a break in precipitation is possible for part of Thursday night before a strong cold front approaches from the west. Ahead of it, we'll likely reach our high temperature for Friday of the low 60s in the morning, as strong northwest winds behind the front will send temperatures falling throughout the rest of the day, that's Friday. A few showers will accompany this front before another break settles in for most of the day into Friday night. Additional disturbances provide shower chances Saturday through Sunday, with chillier highs in the 40s at best. With overnight temperatures falling close to the freezing mark, we're keeping an eye on the potential for a mixed precipitation in this time frame. Right now, our forecast is for all liquid rainfall. If any snow were to mix in, it would be limited in its impact. Temperatures settle into the upper 30s to low 40s for highs for early next week, with hard freezes in the low to mid 20s likely each night. Halloween falls during this big chill, so start thinking about ways to modify costumes for warmth for trick-or-treating next week. Now, turning to the front page of the Courier, we have two articles of local news that we can read. The first is titled, Harvest Rolls Along with Help of Warmer, Dry Conditions. And the story opens up with a photograph of a combine in shadow of the rising sun. It's very dramatic and lots of color with the sunrise. The photograph was taken in Denver, Iowa on Friday. Dateline Des Moines. Dry and warmer than normal temperatures in Iowa last week resulted in 5.7 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Corn and soybean harvest continued to be the primary field activities for the week, although there were reports of fertilizer application and fall tillage. Quote, warmer and generally dry conditions allowed for harvest to take another big step forward, with soybeans nearing completion, unquote. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg said in a news release, quote, a significant weather system with the potential for widespread rain is expected to move through the state later this week, which could idle harvest but alleviate some of the drought conditions, unquote. Disaster proclamations issued by Reynolds as bird flu reappears. Dateline Des Moines. After the state's first case of bird flu this fall was recorded late last week in a commercial turkey flock in Buena Vista County in northwest Iowa, two additional cases were reported on Monday. And here we have a photograph showing cage-free chickens as they're walking in fenced-in pasture at an organic farm near Waukon, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship and the U.S. Department of Agriculture said the new cases are in a commercial turkey flock in Pocahontas County and a mixed species backyard flock in Guthrie County. Governor Kim Reynolds on Friday immediately issued a disaster proclamation for Buena Vista County, her office announced. The proclamation makes available resources from the state agriculture and homeland security departments, plus other agencies, to assist with managing the disease and preventing its spread. Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation Monday for Pocahontas County, making available the same state resources to assist with tracking and monitoring containment, disposal, and disinfection. The proclamation also waives regulatory provisions related to commercial vehicles responding to affected sites. Before Friday, the only other bird flu cases confirmed this year were in January, also in a commercial turkey flock in Buena Vista County, and in March in a backyard flock in Chickasaw County. There were 30 confirmed cases of bird flu in Iowa in 2022, according to state records. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the recent cases of bird flu do not present an immediate public health concern. It remains safe to eat poultry products with proper handling and cooking. Producers who suspect signs of bird flu in their flocks should contact their veterinarian immediately, along with the state officials, at this phone number, area code 515-281-5305. Now, let's turn to the sports page. In high school volleyball, Cedar Falls advanced to state with win over West. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls Tigers are headed back to the Iowa State Volleyball Tournament after defeating Waterloo West 25-17, 26-24, 25-13 in the Class 5A Region 4 Championship on Tuesday. West made Cedar Falls work for the sweep, led by 5 or more points in each of the final two sets, before the Tigers managed to steal the win. And here we have a photograph of a very jubilant Cedar Falls Tigers team. Cedar Falls head coach Matthew Johnson said the Wahawks' ability to keep things closer makes for a great challenge each time the rivals face off. Quote, "You never really feel like on a night like this it is ever going to be your best," Johnson said. "This is what makes playing West really tough. They are like such a high energy and high excitement team. They jump out like 7-1, and they jump out 5-0 because they're confident and playing pretty well." Quote, "We did a good job of not getting flustered by that and just staying steady, fighting back point by point," unquote. In the first set, the Tigers took control, jumping out to a 4-0 lead. The Tigers ultimately took a 9-3 lead before West took a timeout to quell momentum. The Wahawks managed to storm back, tying the game at 11-11 and 12-12. However, the gridlock was short-lived as the Tigers surged down the stretch to win 25-17. The second set looked like it belonged to West as the Wahawks leapt out to a 7-1 lead before Cedar Falls' timeout stalled their momentum. Out of the timeout, Cedar Falls outside hitter Paige Pop recorded 3 kills in the span of 6 points to pull the Tigers within 2, 8-6. West managed to hold on to its lead until Cedar Falls tied the game at 18-all, then took a 19-18 lead on back-to-back return miscues from the Wahawks, forcing a West timeout. West junior Jada Smith rolled out of the timeout with consecutive kills to put West back in front 20-19. West got Cedar Falls onto the ropes 24-22, but the Tigers rattled off 4 straight points to win the second set and take a commanding 2-0 lead. Pop punctuated the victory in set 2 with her 8th kill of the match to power the Tigers' offense through the early deficit and set point. West again took a sizable lead early on in set 3, winning the first 5 points, but the Tigers rallied to win 5 of the next 8 to pull within 8-5. Trailing by 3, an attack error turned the ball back over to Cedar Falls with freshman Kennedy Krecklow at the service line. The underclassman delivered with 3 aces as the Tigers won 9 straight points to jump out to a 14-8 lead. The Tigers cruised the rest of the way to a 25-13 win and a berth in the Class 5A state tournament next week. In college football, UNI stuns and shuts out number 9 North Dakota on homecoming. Story was filed by Ethan Petrick. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa made history on Saturday. The Panthers football team rolled to a 27-0 win over number 9 North Dakota to improve to 4-3 for the season and 3-1 in the Missouri Valley Football Conference play and secure its first shutout of a top 10 team in program history. And here we have a photograph of some of the UNI team members as they celebrate after defensive lineman Christian Boyd sacks North Dakota quarterback Tommy Schuster on Saturday. UNI head coach Mark Farley could not help but crack a smile during his post-game press conference. Quote, "That was as gratifying a win as I can. I can put them up with any of them," Farley said. "It was gratifying because all the things we experienced this week, the movement of players. Quote, "We had a complete movement to make this all happen just because of the depth chart. Through all that, for them to go play the way they did, that was the positive," unquote. The two teams entered on complete opposite ends of the momentum spectrum. North Dakota entered off one of the biggest wins in program history, a 49-24 win over North Dakota State, while UNI came off a historic 41-6 beatdown at the hands of number 1 South Dakota State. Saturday's combatants did not leave the Unidome the way they came in. The Panthers dominated from start to finish, outgaining the Fighting Hawks 402-187 and 163-15 on the ground. Amori Pesek-Hickson, a linebacker, converted to running back during the Panthers' cluster of injuries at the position, powered the Panthers in his first game on offense since transferring from Kansas before the 2022 season. He finished the game with 180 rushing yards and 1 touchdown on 31 attempts. Quote, "I did not expect it, but it did not surprise me," Farley said. "When we move him away from running back, it was only to get him on the field, and we were short at linebacker. He stayed on defense because I thought he may become a starter on defense. Then, with the injuries we took, he was the best choice to go back." Quote, "He is a very good athlete. He has really grown as a player, and that is why we had the day we had," unquote. The Panthers punched the Fighting Hawks in the mouth in the first half, taking a 3-score lead into the halftime break. After going 3-and-out on their opening offensive possession, the Panthers' defense came up big with a fumble recovery as North Dakota quarterback Tommy Schuster lost the ball on an exchange during a read option play on 3rd-and-5 deep in UNI territory. UNI defensive lineman Caden Huftelling recovered the fumble in his first game this season. The Panthers took over on their own 34-yard line and marched 65 yards on 7 plays to take a 7-0 lead. Pesek-Hickson punctuated the drive with a 14-yard touchdown run, scampering untouched on a sweep around the left side of the offensive line. The former Kansas transfer, where he played running back, toted the ball 5 times on the drive for 40 yards. Although it was his first touchdown in college, Pesek-Hickson managed a business-like mentality to the moment. Quote, I just tried to find my mom as I was running in there, Pesek Hickson said. I am not like an emotional person. At the end of the day, football is my life. But in the grand scheme of things, with my faith, it really does not mean that much. I want to continue playing football for this team and keep winning games. After the Panthers' defense forced a punt, Matthew Cook connected on a 30-yard field goal to cap an 11-play, 67-yard drive and push UNI's lead to 10-0 with 11 minutes, 40 seconds to play in the half. Needing a response, the Fighting Hawks drove deep into UNI territory, converting a fourth and short in the process. However, a huff-telling sack pushed UNI back to the UNI 17 and forced a field goal try from 34 yards out, which C.J. Elricks missed. Smelling blood in the water, UNI offensive coordinator dialed up a play familiar to Panther fans as quarterback Theo Day connected with Sergio Morency for a 70-yard touchdown to take a 17-0 lead with 3 minutes 40 seconds to go before halftime. Out of the break, the Panthers' defense forced a 3-and-out, allowing the offense to stretch the lead to 24-0 with 9 minutes to go in the third quarter. Day caps the drive with a 2-yard strike to wide receiver Brady McCullough, who made a leaping grab at the back line of the end zone for his first touchdown in a Panther uniform. Neither team scored until the 2-minute 30 mark of the fourth quarter, when Cook connected on a 35-yard field goal to give UNI its final advantage of 27-0. Quote, when we came back off the road after the South Dakota State game, I was thinking about that all the way on the bus ride, Farley said. Quote, of what we need to do as early as Sunday to start making these decisions on Monday so we can get to this game. North Dakota is a very good football team, an exceptional football team. What our team accomplished tonight was special, unquote. Now back to local news from the Courier. Boys and Girls Club buys Elk Run Preschool. City to develop new homes on part of land. Dateline is Elk Run Heights. Changes are coming to a former Waterloo Community School's preschool site after the property was sold to two buyers. The Board of Education on Monday approved selling Elk Run Preschool at 316 McCoy Road to the Boys and Girls Club of the Cedar Valley for $5,000. At its previous meeting, the board sold land behind the building to Elk Run Heights for $1. The city intends to use the land for residential development. Discussions over what to do with the lots emerged last summer when both the City of Elk Run Heights and Tyson Fresh Foods approached the district with their hopes of obtaining the preschool. Plans fell through with both. Elk Run Heights Mayor Lisa Smock said the property would cost too much for the city to buy and tear down. The original hope was that the land would hold a new city hall and a residential area. Smock also said the idea of the district partnering with Tyson came to an end after a discussion from higher up in the company. Tyson was hoping to turn the building into a preschool for its employees. The Boys and Girls Club has been using the space for about a year after moving out of the strip mall in Evansdale. About 45 children currently use the facility, but Brian Burton, the CEO of the organization, said more than 100 kids could receive programming with the purchase of the building. He said families from communities such as Evansdale, Elk Run Heights, Raymond, and Gilbertville will be able to use the services when they previously had none in their communities. Quote, a lot of parents work in Waterloo, and kids go home and are by themselves, Burton said, noting that children would receive health, social, emotional, and physical education at their building. Quote, this has been a godsend for us, unquote. The organization will start off using the south side of the building and the gym. It will work on adding heating and cooling to the north end, and then hopefully use the whole building when more kids join the program. During the school year, children can receive programming from the time they get out of school until 7 p.m. In the summer, there will be full-day programs from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Burton said the cost for children is $30 per year, which includes both summer and school year programming. Smock said it breaks her heart that there isn't a school in Elk Run Heights anymore, but the Boys and Girls Club is the next best thing for families. She also said hopefully increasing the city's tax base with new housing is just as beneficial to the community. She said she asked for the land for $1 because the district acquired the property for the same amount when they built the elementary school that ran from the 1950s to 2007. Smock said she's in the beginning phases of talking to developers and creating renderings. The plan is to build 12 residences, either single-family homes or condos on the lot. Only one road would need to be constructed, along with water and sewer lines installed under that road. She hopes construction will start in 2024, and homes will be for sale in 2025. As for the cost, she's hoping to incentivize developers using a tax increment financing district or tax rebates. She said residents will not pay for the project. Elk Run Heights hasn't seen new development since the city bought a trailer court on Lafayette Road in 2013. The last house built there was around 2017. Smock believes the new development behind the former preschool will bring a type of housing that they don't currently have in town, smaller single-family homes with smaller yards for less maintenance. She said that Elk Run Heights offers many amenities to new families, such as a park directly across McCoy Road, a dog park, and trails. It's also minutes away from Waterloo and Cedar Falls, but residents do have lower taxes than they would in those cities. If she's reelected on November 7th, Smock wants to focus on housing and commercial development in the city. Quote, "Anytime we get new residents or we see new development, it brings us new energy," she said. "It brings us into a whole new group of people that'll make this a better place to live." Hawkeye Community College Board seeks bids to revamp administration building lobby. Story by Angela Sturm McLaughlin. Dateline Waterloo. The lobby of Hawkeye Community College's administrative building will be renovated for the first time in nearly a decade. The Board of Trustees Monday approved seeking bids for the remodeling project at Hawkeye Center, which will be paid for through the plant fund. Construction costs are estimated at $485,000. Design fees and a contingency fund are estimated at $163,000. Administration officials noted that brightening up the center, moving the reception desk, and updating the Hawkeye mural are part of the project. Cost estimates for furniture, which will not be included in this bid, are undetermined at this point. Hawkeye Center, the administrative heart of the campus, is often a visitor's first impression of the college. Financial aid, admissions, student services, the business office, and public safety are all housed there. It is also the building frequented by both current and prospective faculty and staff for human resource services. In addition, the building houses the offices of the President and Hawkeye Foundation, as well as hosting many meetings, including gatherings open to the public, such as the monthly trustees meeting. Hawkeye Center has gone through two renovations since it was built. In 2008, the metal and glass grand staircase was added to the main rotunda, and in 2015, the center had some minor updates to make the lower-level restrooms compliant with the Americans with Disability Act. RDG Planning and Design of Omaha, Nebraska is the project's designer. The board will hold a public hearing on November 28th on the improvements and consider approving a contract. Construction is set to start in December, with the renovation work completed in March. As Hawkeye Center gets a facelift, the Cedar Falls Center, which houses business and community education classes, is looking to expand as well. Trustees unanimously approved a motion to enter into a lease with D&D Midwest Investments for a temporary lab space at 5611 Westminster Drive until September 2025. Hawkeye will use the area as a lab space for its youth summer construction program, floor covering apprenticeship and carpentry apprenticeships. Hawkeye will pay $1,250 monthly for the 1,872 square foot space. Now, from the Capital Notebook, A.G. Byrd highlights office's new role in election security. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd filed public notice Tuesday, reminded Iowans that, under a new state law, her office will prosecute election fraud and misconduct cases. In a news release, Byrd highlighted a portion of Governor Kim Reynolds' state government reorganization plan that was approved by the Republican majority legislature and signed into law by Reynolds this year. One section of the wide-ranging law gave the Attorney General's office authority to prosecute elections crimes. Quote, "It's critical that we maintain Iowans' trust in our election systems," Byrd said in the news release. Quote, "No Iowan should have to worry about whether their vote will count. I am committed to ensuring the safety and security of our elections so that every Iowan's voice is heard," unquote. Byrd, also a Republican, recently endorsed former President Donald Trump in the GOP presidential primary. Trump, over the past 3 years, has made false claims of fraud in the 2020 presidential election that he lost to President Joe Biden. Those 2020 results have been confirmed by state elections leaders from both major political parties, and all legal challenges to the results were defeated or dismissed. Trump has been indicted on charges of attempting to have the presidential election results in Georgia overturned. Multiple Trump associates have already pleaded guilty to similar charges in that case. In Tuesday's news release, Byrd said Iowa state law prohibits any action that interferes with an Iowan's right to vote or allows for the casting of an illegal vote, and listed as examples registration and voter fraud, bribery, voter intimidation, and voting equipment tampering. In the news release, Byrd encouraged any Iowan concerned about potential election misconduct to report it to their local law enforcement agency. She said any questions regarding election procedures should go to the county auditor or the Iowa Secretary of State's office, which oversees elections in the state. The state's first election since the new state law went on the books July 1st is underway. Early voting has already started in municipal elections for city and school positions, among others. Election day is November 7th. Iowans get relief from lenders' settlement. Iowa will receive nearly $70,000 as part of a 42-state lawsuit with a lending company that was accused of deceptive advertising and leasing practices, according to the Iowa Attorney General's office. The settlement is the result of allegations that Tempo LLC deceived consumers into signing leases for goods instead of using payment installment plans or credit. According to a news release from the Attorney General's office, Tempo's methods, quote, "confused Iowans, leading them to paying 2 to 3 times the purchase price of the goods, which included mattresses, lawn and garden items, and tires." The roughly $70,000 from the settlement will go to the Iowa Attorney General's office and can be used for education or litigation regarding consumer fraud and financial issues, per the settlement agreement. Also, Tempo is permanently banned from engaging in future leasing activities in Iowa, and all existing leases will be canceled, and Iowans may keep any leased products without any further financial obligation. Tempo also cannot give credit reporting agencies negative information about Iowans who leased from the company. And next, $11 million allocated for traffic safety. Iowa will receive $11 million in federal grant funds for traffic safety, the governor's Traffic Safety Bureau announced. The grant funds from National Highway Traffic Safety Administration will be distributed to law enforcement partners for equipment, education, and enforcement projects, and to other traffic safety partners like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, and others, according to the State Bureau. And now, listeners, we'd like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 25th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
It only took Jeff one interview to land his job, one smile to get his wife to go out with him, and one time to risk it all by trying meth. Meth. Never, ever. Visit yourliveiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from the New York Times, written by Ron Curie Jr. The title is, "This is what keeps my eco-anxiety in check. From spring until late fall, when winter weather drives me indoors to the treadmill, I spend 20 minutes each morning after my run around the Back Cove in Portland, Maine, walking the shoreline, picking up garbage. Every day is Groundhog Day. I gather plastic cups, syringes, food containers, and cigarette butts, the same as the morning before, and the same as the morning before that. I should almost certainly feel despair battling the daily fallout as late capitalism enters hospice care. But instead, I get a base, primal satisfaction from actually just doing something, no matter how insignificant. We've forgotten, maybe, as the virtual world has slowly co-opted our lives, that we are meant by nature to move through and manipulate, to lift and carry, and sort and transfer. Some acts, I've found, have an outsized effect on the worrying over abstractions that otherwise takes up so much of my time. My education in this regard started one morning a few years ago when, getting ready for a run, I looked up and saw a seagull with what looked like a small fish clutched in one of her feet. It wasn't a fish, but a fishing lure, and its barbed hook had stabbed the gull's foot and lodged there. She flew wide, despairing circles above me, trying to shake the hook loose, while other birds, seemingly making the same mistake I'd made in thinking the lure was an actual fish, gave chase. That day, instead of doing a more conventional walk and stretch after running, I finally acted on an impulse I'd had many times and started moving slowly along the perimeter of the cove, picking up garbage. My grief over the gull's suffering receded ever so slightly as I went. The satisfaction I get from this habit is not uncomplicated. Sometimes I take paradoxical pleasure in getting dirty with other people's trash, and other times the surprise dollop of last night's honey mustard sauce on my shoe is enough to send me directly over the edge. But the daily practice has taught me to be on guard against my own vanity, to notice and discard the smug feeling that sometimes arises when I see others enjoying the cove, but doing nothing about how blighted it is. Instead, I am confronted each day with my own failability, tinniness, and hypocrisy. As just one more trash ape among billions, I contribute to the problem simply by existing. And instead of puffing myself up, I check myself and reach for more garbage. There are likely more effective things I could be doing with my time. We live in an age when efficiency and optimization are prized above all else. And what could be less efficient than gathering scraps of garbage by hand when the equivalent of a dump truck of plastics enters the ocean every minute? So I've tried to think and do bigger. I've thought about sabotaging a pig farm or an oil rig, but have had to admit to myself that I'm ultimately not a radical. I've considered giving up my work as a writer for a career in ecological activism. But the whole reason I do this work is because I am, at heart, a loner. I mistrust groups larger than, say, half a dozen people. In my experience, that's when we start getting a little too certain about what everyone on our side of the line believes, usually to the detriment of ourselves and everything else. In short, I'm skeptical both of working within any system and of trying to upend it, which is another way of saying I'm skeptical of my own species. It's hard not to be, given the evidence. Climate change and other ecological consequences of human activity are both incomprehensibly large and diffuse, and thus easy to distance ourselves from. Our very own personal garbage, however, and our habits in disposing of it are not so easy to disavow, and they are damning. So instead of blowing up a plastics factory, I go and gather garbage by myself most days, and occasionally something will occur that happily disproves my dim view of humanity. People will notice me and wonder what I'm doing all sweaty and breathless down there among the marsh grass and the rocks. I present an intriguing enough figure for them to stop in the midst of their preoccupations with the day and take the time to discern what I'm up to. And when they figure out that I am, in fact, picking up garbage, sometimes, not often, but occasionally, they'll come and join me. We'll chat, or, more likely, we won't do much other than exchange hellos or simply nod. Just a couple of strangers doing something small and futile together, for no other reason than that it's right. The kind of modest workaday miracle that feels like it could, with any luck, lead to something bigger. It seems near all but certain that we are, as a species, too short-sighted and distractible, too enamored of dividend checks and retail therapy, to really turn this ship around. But then, despair and idealism are two sides of the same cop-out, and I've indulged in both more than enough in my time. So I'll keep splitting the difference, keeping picking up trash, and keep hoping that simply setting an example can be meaningful. Note, Ron Currie Jr. is the author of the novel The One-Eyed Man, and a writer for film and television, most recently for the series Extrapolations. Next, from the New York Times, Why My Fall Made Me Feel So Ashamed, written by Danny Shapiro. The morning after I fell, I lay in bed assessing the damage. My knees were banged up. The right one was painful and swollen. I felt for the bandage my husband had secured around my chin the night before. It was still in place, sticky with blood. My jaw ached. I ran my tongue around my teeth. None seemed to be broken. A near miss, I thought. Disparate verses from one of my favorite poems by Wolosa Szymborska looped through my mind. It could have happened. It had to happen. It happened, but not to you. We had been walking back to our car after dinner with friends. The night was clear. The sidewalk was smooth. Because it was raining, because of the shade, because the day was sunny. What had I been thinking about the moment before? Plans, probably. My meetings the following day, or whether we were running low on coffee. I wasn't paying attention to my feet on the pavement or my body moving through space until both knees and my chin hit the ground. I shot up instantly. I'm okay, I said to my horrified husband. And friends, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. I practically chanted it like a prayer, as if saying it might somehow make it true. The thing is, I wasn't okay. I swung my legs out of bed and tested my weight. I made my way to the top of the stairs, grabbed the banister, and took them one by one. Each step felt treacherous, as if the world had tilted on its axis, and I alone were about to slide off. It was a familiar feeling, by which I don't mean that I experienced injuries like these before, but rather that a shadow had revealed itself, a powerful reminder that life is uncontrollable and unpredictable, and we are fragile. She always had the feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway knew the score. That's what they don't tell you about falls. You keep falling again and again. You fall off curbs. You fall down the stairs. You fall in the shower. You are an astronaut floating and flailing through space, while everyone surrounding you seems to be on terra firma. Life reveals itself as that childhood game, Chutes and Ladders, in which you spin the arrow and land on an unfortunate square, and down you go. Your mind does this to you, and it does something else too. When we fall, we are consumed with embarrassment and its more toxic cousin, shame. Mortified by our fragility and its accompanying whisper of aging and death. Most days, we can pretend that we're in control. We supply narratives when something happens that doesn't make immediate sense or threatens our illusions of safety. We like nothing better than a reason. In the case of a fall, we might first look outward. A crack in the sidewalk, a hole in the pavement, those stupid shoes. Parentheses, my mother once tripped and fell on West 86th Street and considered suing the city of New York. But soon, a more insistent voice seeps in. It was my fault. Now they'll see me for who I really am. Weak, frail, alone. A fall is different from an accident or an act of violence. It is not something done to you, but something you have done. I had been an agent of my own near catastrophe. My trust in myself had been broken, along with, as I soon learned, my jaw. This is what shame does. It isolates us by telling us we're weird and wrong. That's the only way it can do its work on us. As word of my fall circulated, I wanted to hide. I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. When I did speak with people, I emphasized how lucky I was, how much worse it could have been. I reframed myself as fortunate, even though my toes were curled around the edge of the abyss. But then I posted about my fall on social media, and the comments flooded in. There were lovely well wishes and plenty of prayers and light and offers of soup being sent my way. But what surprised me were the stories. For a while, the comments section of my Instagram account became a community of people, mostly women, not only commiserating but relating, identifying and offering the details of their own falls. Fell off a horse at a wedding, after tripping over a dog, carrying my toddler daughter, flat on the sidewalk, breaking my sacrum, from my racing bike, into a ditch, in my own home doing nothing but the very ordinary, while getting into a rocky boat, hitting my brow bone, hard in the shower, displacing a tailbone, passing out, down the stairs, breaking my neck and face, shaken to the core. Shaken to the core. When we're injured, we're suddenly separated from the herd of the healthy. But now I saw that I wasn't alone. Difficulties befall, that word, every one of us. So what is the use of self-blame and shame? The Chutes are just a spin of the dial away. We could choose to see that as petrifying and unacceptable, or we could understand it as tender and beautiful. Acknowledgement of this fundamental human truth might just save us. A season has passed since that evening I lay face down on the pavement. I have stopped reliving the moment during every waking hour, though it still haunts my dreams. My body is recovering, but I suspect the healing I need to do does go deeper than fractured bones. In the waterfall of comments made by strangers who reached out their hands to grasp mine and pull me back to my feet, in their willingness to say, me too, there is a lesson to be learned. If we all could acknowledge our shared fragility, shame would disappear. Next, why so many Americans are losing trust in science. This appeared in the New York Times and was written by M. Anthony Mills. Dr. Mandy Cohen has been on a national tour. The new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, she aims to rebuild trust in that troubled agency at a moment when COVID-19 cases are rising again and the Biden administration has begun a new vaccine campaign. She has her work cut out for her. According to new survey data, 69% of Americans this past May said they had confidence in scientists to act in the public's best interest, compared with 86% of Americans who told the Pew Research Center in a similar survey that they had confidence in scientists in January of 2019. Meanwhile, vaccine skepticism has become one of the most divisive political issues of our time. How did we get here? Many see Americans' anti-vaccine and anti-mask attitudes as only the latest expression of a long-standing science denialism prevalent among Republicans. This anti-science mentality, the argument goes, stems from an anti-government ideology that took root in the Republican Party during the 1980s and has matured into antipathy toward not just government, but science as well. Basically, the populist skepticism unleashed by Donald Trump is the logical successor to Ronald Reagan's small government conservatism. Yet Americans' changing attitudes toward science in recent years reveal a rather different, more complex, and frankly, unsettling picture. It is not simply that Americans disagree about particular pandemic policies or that some distrust particular expert institutions. Instead, many Americans, especially but not only conservatives, have grown highly distrustful of institutions of all kinds, creating fertile soil for conspiracies and other extreme views to take root. This, in turn, raises the disturbing prospect of a new politics polarized not so much around public policies, but around trust itself, and the public figures who successfully mobilize trust or distrust. Restoring faith, therefore, may prove vital for a functioning society. To get there, experts must consider how and why so many Americans now consider them and the institutions they represent to be unworthy of their confidence. Traditional small government conservatives are market-oriented, trusting private industry over public sector to meet society's demands. In general, they favor less regulation than liberals. For instance, a familiar free market criticism of the Food and Drug Administration is that it can be overly cautious, preventing or delaying life-saving medicines developed by the pharmaceutical industry from reaching consumers out of a disproportionate concern for potential harmful side effects. Thus, one might have expected Republicans to embrace the mRNA COVID vaccines developed during Operation Warp Speed. Not only did vaccines offer the surest path to easing pandemic restrictions, but they were also a private sector innovation, sponsored but not fully directed by the government, under a Republican administration, no less. Moreover, the mission succeeded in part by streamlining the kind of FDA regulatory hurdles Republicans used to criticize. Instead, of course, many conservatives became highly distrustful of COVID vaccines, invoking the very precautionary logic Republicans once rejected on free market grounds. Skeptics dismiss the mRNA vaccines as experimental and dangerous, claiming they were developed too hastily and without adequate consideration of their risks. Such worries are not limited to prominent skeptics or right-wing media personalities. According to the new survey data from the Survey Center on American Life at the American Enterprise Institute, the nonprofit where I am a senior fellow, Republicans overall were much less likely than Democrats to be fully vaccinated against COVID. They were also much more concerned about the serious adverse effects of vaccines in general, and were less likely than Democrats to accept the overwhelming scientific consensus that childhood vaccines do not cause autism. The Republican drift from a market-friendly worldview isn't limited to Operation Warp Speed. The survey found that Republicans were as skeptical of research produced by industry scientists as their counterparts on the left, and they were much more likely than Democrats to say corporations were promoting harmful genetically modified organisms or pressuring the FDA to prevent natural cures for cancer and other diseases. None of this means the GOP has suddenly become the party of big government. Republicans still often couch their criticism of public health policies in the language of individual freedom, and some of the first political protests of the pandemic opposed business closures on economic grounds. Republicans also remain far more skeptical of regulation than Democrats, even as they grow more distrustful of industry. Yet conservative attitudes toward science since the pandemic do not look like an expression, however exaggerated, of traditional small government conservatism. Instead, they look like a thoroughgoing skepticism of society institutions writ large, a skepticism that is neither pro-government nor simply anti-government. There is empirical support for the idea that declining trust in science is a function of institutional distrust in general. Our survey found that self-reported confidence in institutions, including governmental, news media, academic, religious, and scientific organizations, was positively correlated with vaccination status. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans in the top quartile of institutional trust reported being fully vaccinated, compared with half of those in the bottom quartile. Could we be entering a new political order polarized around institutional trust? Our increasing tendency to treat trust in scientific experts as markers of political tribe suggests as much. A politics of trust would bode ill not only for expert institutions, but also for democratic society. Trust may be indispensable to the functioning of modern societies, but too much trust in large impersonal systems of expert knowledge is antithetical to democratic self-governance. A healthy politics strikes a balance between the two. Institutional trust leavened by healthy skepticism. Trust and skepticism are dispositions that must be balanced within parties, indeed, within individual people, not bifurcated along partisan lines. A politics suspended between radical skepticism and uncritical trust would become unmoored from common reference points and, almost by definition, preclude compromise and accommodation. Experts would be either angels or demons, rather than human beings whose expertise we need, but who nevertheless sometimes err or even sometimes put their own interests above the public's. Restoring public trust, as Dr. Cohen of the CDC aims to do, is therefore necessary for not only expert institutions, but arguably also democratic society itself. But trust is a two-way street. Restoring it will require careful and perhaps even painful self-scrutiny on the part of those institutions to learn why they lost the confidence of so many Americans during the past 4 years. Note, M. Anthony Mills is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and an author of a study on public mistrust and vaccine hesitancy in the wake of COVID. Now back to local news from the Courier. Louie Louie, friendly, gentle therapy dog, calms students at Hudson Community Schools. Story filed by Melody Parker. Dateline is Hudson. Clearly, Louie likes being in the thick of things. When the buzzer sounds, classroom doors open and students stream into the hallways at Hudson Community Schools. Plumed tail at full wag, the golden retriever is swarmed by students. His calm and friendly demeanor invites pats and the occasional hug from the children, which he thoroughly enjoys. Louie's owner, Mary Seekins, calls these pet-and-go moments. As the kids walk past Louie, they can stop and give him a pat or a hug on his neck, then move on and stay on track for their next class or activity. Quote, he just loves it. He loves being out in the hallway, surrounded by kids, said Seekins, a 7th and 8th grade resource teacher at Hudson Middle School. Louie, a certified therapy dog, goes to school every day with Seekins. She said the 4-year-old retriever instinctively knows what time they leave for school. Quote, he beats me to the door. I open the car door and he hops right in. He's always so good. He knows where we're going and he looks forward to it, unquote. He is the first ever therapy dog at Hudson Community School District. Seekins has been a longtime advocate for therapy dogs in the classroom. Quote, for 10 years, I've been begging Dr. Voss, telling him we need a therapy dog. I've heard and read about so many positive things that a therapy dog can bring to a school. I just about fell over when he told me we could, she said. Quote, I didn't so much surprise her as much as she wore me down, said Superintendent Tony Voss with a laugh. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, that is iowaradioreading.org, and you can do that at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.